Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
A big thanks to Beto da Silva for his entertainment this afternoon. It's Tuesday the 20th of August. You're now listening to Game On and I'm Ruby Walsh. So the Sports Direct FAI quarter-final cup draws were made today earlier today, and the draw Alan Cawley didn't want last night happened. Shells will play Derry City in the quarter-finals and Conan Byrne will be here to discuss those draws with us. Fergal Brennan will then join in to look back at Leicester City and Spurs last night and to discuss all the transfer news and gossip in the Premier League. Tomorrow afternoon is day one of the Sky Bet Ebor Festival, a very international affair on the Knavesmire in York, and Aidan O'Brien heads up the Irish contingent that are travelling. He will take a call to let us know how City of Troy and the rest of his team are going, including Los Angeles and whatever else he has heading for the Knavesmire. Stage 4 of the Vuelta de España climb from Plasencia to Pico Villarrucas this afternoon. Shane Stokes will take a call to fill us in on all the action in Spain, and Isabel Joyce will fill us in on the Ireland women's cricket team's 2-1 series wins over Sri Lanka in the One Day Internationals. If you want to have your say on Game On, you can text us on 51552. We're on WhatsApp at 087 187 9200, and we're on the X platform. Well, the show is, I'm not, at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
So, some brief bits of news for you this afternoon. Leinster have confirmed that they will play their 2024-2025 Champions Cup pool games at the Aviva Stadium due to ongoing redevelopment work at the RDS. Of course, the Anglesey stand started to come down yesterday morning. Last season's runner-ups have been drawn in a pool alongside long-standing foes La Rochelle, Clermont Auvergne and Premiership duo Bath and Bristol Bears. Leos Cullen's side are set to face Clermont on Saturday the 14th of December at 5:30 in the Aviva, and they will play Bath at home on the 18th of January at 5:30 p.m. as well. In tennis news, world number one Jannik Sinner has been cleared of any wrongdoing after twice testing positive for a banned substance in March. The Italian tested positive for low levels of a metabolite of clostebol, a steroid that can be used to build muscle mass during Indian Wells. A further sample taken 8 days later also tested positive for low levels of the same metabolite. A provisional suspension was automatically applied, but Sinner challenged it successfully. He was unable to keep playing. The International Tennis Integrity Agency carried out an investigation which found Sinner was inadvertently contaminated with the substance by his physiotherapist. The physiotherapist had been applying an over-the-counter spray available in Italy to a cut on his own hand. He then carried out treatments on Sinner, resulting in inadvertent contamination. The ITIA accepted the explanation and that the violation was not intentional. And finally, in cricket news, the 2024 Women's T20 World Cup will be moved from Bangladesh to the United Arab Emirates following civil unrest in the original host country. The International Cricket Council said in a statement that the tournament will now be staged at two venues in the UAE, Dubai and Sharjah, between the 3rd and 20th of October. Of course, Bangladesh's former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina resigned and fled to India this month after weeks of deadly anti-government protests. That's all the sports news we have. I'm delighted to say that Conan Byrne is in studio to join us to discuss the Sports Direct FAI quarter-final draws. Alan Cawley was hoping last night, Conan, that Derry City wouldn't be drawn against Shells. They have been. What's your take on it?
Oh, geez, it's a tough one, Ruby, because that's what you'd be hoping for in a cup final in terms of the Derry Shells one. That's what I was hoping for anyway. I'm sure Alan was the same last night.
Exactly the same.
Yeah, because previous years, I think it was 2 years ago, Derry played Shells in the cup final. Great occasion, great numbers from both sets of supporters at the Aviva Stadium. Yeah, and they get thrown against each other in the quarterfinal stage. Feels kind of sorry for Derry, considering the draw they've had so far. They've played Pats at home, away to Cork, and now they're home to Shell. So they're taking, they have to play the big sides and in order to get through to the semi-final of this competition. So they have a home tie. They'd have wanted that anyway, but probably coming up against the toughest opponent in the draw in Shells in terms of current form, league leaders, themselves trying to chase Shelburne for that title. That has eluded both clubs for so many years. So, yeah, it's going to be a very interesting spectacle, and it's definitely the pick of the ties in that quarter-final draw.
It most certainly is. The ties will be played between the 13th and 15th of September. UCD have drawn Bowes, a Dublin derby. Bowes had to be Kerry on penalties to get here, but UCD went to Sligo and got a result.
Yeah, and they had a wonderful result down in Sligo, because Sligo have been on a great run of form, Ruby, over the last number of weeks. They picked up five wins out of six. Their defeat was against St. Pat's, where they were controversially awarded a last minute penalty for Pat's, and it was just an awful decision in the game that gave Pat's the 3 points. But other than that, they've been flawless. So coming up against UCD, would have expected Sligo to be comfortable winners in the night. But UCD came out, and two great goals from Luke O'Regan and Adam Wells sent them through to the quarterfinal stage. So they'll be full of confidence now in a home tie against Bohemians, who, like you said, struggled down in Kerry. Against all odds, you would have thought, considering where Kerry have come from. But Kerry are doing great things down in the kingdom, and Kelleher with two fortunate enough goals, very poor defensively from a Bowes point of view. So UCD will have their tails up certainly going into that game. You'd still expect Bohemians to pull through, though.
Of course you would. Athlone Town have drawn Drogheda United. One is going well in one division, one not going so well in another.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And with, I suppose, Waterford will be really disappointed. So Athlone beat Waterford on Friday 3-2 after extra time, but a very controversial red card in the first half for Dara Leahy that has since been overturned by the disciplinary panel of the FAI. So I'm sure Waterford will be seething over that. Considering there was nothing in the incident at all, referee gave a red card, and ultimately Waterford played a large portion of that game at 10 men, and got beaten 3-2 after extra time. So really disappointing from their point of view, because you would have expected them to pull through that round. But Athlone, like you said, are doing really well in that first division, and a great signing by from Athlone to sign Dean Ebb, and he's been in great form, goal scoring form anyway. And like you say, Drogheda in the Premier Division, struggling at the tail, at the bottom end of it, really poor this season. You'd expect them, especially going full-time next season, to really buy at the bit and to try and pick up some good results. They won 9-0 in their game on Friday against non-league Wilton United, but they need to pick up their league form, and that's what they'll be aiming to do more so than this FAI Cup run. It's a nice distraction for them, but the league is where they want it to be. They need to get out of that 10th position and fast. So that could be an upset there between Athlone and Drogheda.
There might be, but it's guaranteed to be a First Division side in the semi-finals, and it's a big opportunity for either Wexford FC or Treaty United.
Yeah, and Wexford both had great victories. Wexford beat Ballyferrin United 3-0 away from home on Friday evening. That was a great result for them. And Treaty 7-0 home winners over Pike Rovers, a great Limerick derby there on Friday. So Wexford are probably doing a little bit better in terms of form, home tie as well. So yeah, you'd expect Wexford to get through. And it's great to see that First Division side getting to a semi-final, Ruby. You know, and remember when Sporting Fingal were the last First Division side to win the FAI Cup back in 2009, they had to get through a couple of, obviously you have to play some good teams on the way to a final, but in the semi-final we played a team that were bottom end of the Premier Division and got through into the final and played Sligo Rovers. So it happens. I think the last team to play European football whilst in the First Division was Dundalk, if memory serves me right. That's going to be a very interesting tie, and even the semi-final draw as a result of these quarter-final ties is going to be very interesting as well.
Well, I'm definitely not going to question your memory, Conan, that I will guarantee you, but for the FAI, do they need Bowes to get to the final Derry City or Shelburne to get the crowd they need? Can any of the four or five teams bring a big enough crowd?
In a word, no. So the FAI would probably want Bowes, Derry or Shells in the final, 100%. Bowes would bring a crowd, there's no doubt about that. We've seen that before when they played Europa Conference League football against Pauk, and in the previous couple of seasons where they've played St. Patrick's Athletic in the final, both defeated by the Saints, and they brought huge numbers to the Aviva Stadium. And the same with Derry and Shelburne. The crowds now in Premier Division football and all over the country, Ruby, is growing and growing. But in terms of trying to fill an Aviva Stadium, you'd need a Derry or a Shells, and then obviously a Bowes to get there to make it a great event. That's not to take nothing away from the other teams. If they get to the final, they're fully deserving of that. But in terms of the FAI and trying to get numbers in, yeah, definitely they'll be looking for those bigger clubs to make it there.
Big week in Europe as well, of course, for Shamrock Rovers and St Pat's. They're soldiering away, as the fella says, in their bid to play European football. What do you think? How do you think they'll get on this week?
Yeah, look, Shamrock Rovers coming up against Pauk, only lost to Malmo in the Champions League 6-5 in aggregate, and Pauk have only started their Greek campaign this season with a 3-2 opening game win. You see, I always look back on Pauk played Bohemians in that Europa Conference League game, the Aviva Stadium that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, and you kind of look back to see that the players that played that day, which was only 3 years ago to today, and only one player who started against Bohs actually played against Malmo in that second leg. So his name is Andreja Zivkovic, an absolute brilliant footballer from Serbia. Played in the Euros, started two of the games against Denmark and Slovenia, and came on as a sub against England. He's going to be the player that Stephen Bradley will be watching out for the most. Excellent player. But they've players all over the pitch, obviously, considering their pedigree. Brandon Thomas played La Liga football with Osasuna. I don't know if any Chelsea fans will remember Abdul Baba. He played in the Premier League with Chelsea back in 2015-2016 season. So they have players all over the pitch that can cause Shamrock Rovers a lot of problems. But having said that, Shamrock Rovers, we've seen how capable they are at Talla Stadium. And I think that's the most important thing, that they can bring something back from their away leg to Talla, and then anything can happen.
Anything can happen. Did you enjoy the Leicester City Spurs match last night?
Brilliant game. Absolutely brilliant game. And I fully expected after 15-20 minutes of that game to see Tottenham run away 2-3, 4-0 winners on the night. I thought they were really, really good going forward. Pedro Porro playing in that right back position that you just love seeing him getting forward, and obviously he got his goal. Just as I said, dominated the game. And then just something clicked at half time. It was like Ipswich Liverpool when in that game there was a tactical switch at half time, obviously by Arne Slot. I think Cooper did the same thing for Leicester. Just gave Tottenham way too much, I don't know, possession and in the game in that first half, and they needed to change it, and they did. They came out, and I thought their fullbacks in particular, James Justin and Victor Christensen, who was recently signed from Bologna, excellent player. I went to see Lazio play Bologna back in February, and he was one of the standout players in that Bologna team that day. So it was no surprise to see him get his chance in the Premier League, and he's taken it. He was absolutely brilliant last night. And then obviously Jamie Vardy, 37 years of age, back with a bang with his first Premier League goal in a couple of years. It was great to see him off the mark. And I think Leicester deserved their point in the end. But just in the sense of the possession stats that Spurs had, 15 goal attempts, 7 of them on target, you would have expected them to get the 3 points coming away from Leicester, but unfortunately it wasn't to be.
Conan, I know you're a very busy man, you have teams to coach, so head on and do that. Thanks a million for taking time to talk to us this evening. Fergal Brennan, you are on the line as well. What does Ange have to do to get Tottenham to convert possession into winning points?
I think they just have to be a bit more ruthless in terms of the chances that are getting created. They sometimes, I think particularly James Maddison, talented as he is, he's guilty of wanting to be too precise, wanting to play the perfect pass, the kind of defence splitter that creates the opportunity to score. They have got efficiency in attack. Song Heung-min's been one of the most prolific attacking players. You might not call him an out-and-out striker, but he's been one of the most prolific attacking players in the Premier League in the last 5 years. Yes, obviously, no Harry Kane last season, and they're still missing him in that sense. Dominic Solanke came in and had a couple of chances last night, was maybe unlucky to not get at least a debut goal. I wouldn't be reading too much into that just yet, but there is a bit of a question mark over him. He was really impressive for Bournemouth last year, 19 Premier League goals, but it was Bournemouth, and playing for Tottenham, the level of responsibility, the level of pressure, the huge price tag, he'd broken the club transfer record to get him in, that will all weigh on those players as individuals and as an attacking unit. The focus is on Postecoglou to try and relieve a bit of that pressure, which we know he's quite good at. But I do think, looking at last night, just that ability in the really crunch moments to be efficient. There's an opportunity, put it away. Leicester's best chance of the night, Leicester's only real big chance of the night, fell to Vardy, 37 years young, back of the net, done. And that got them a point. I'm not saying, obviously, Tottenham go out by Jamie Vardy, but sometimes you just need to get it done, get the box ticked, get that second goal, Leicester lose the momentum, and then Tottenham get themselves an opening win. Because they didn't do that, they're going to be the disappointed ones going back to London last night, because they are far more favoured to win that game. Leicester are newly promoted. Yes, they're at home. But it's a chance missed for Tottenham. And it's something that Postecoglou needs to look at to see how he can get his players to gel. But they need to get more efficient.
I was glad to see Leicester getting the point. Obviously, Ipswich were no match for Liverpool at the weekend, but I felt Southampton were unlucky not to get something as well. The three teams that came up, two of them could have got something out of the opening weekend, and I think that makes for a better Premier League.
It does, and I think that the Southampton thing, it was such an odd game because it was dominated so much about the red card and the issue with Ben Brereton Diaz and Fabian Schär that we didn't really get an accurate picture of what we can expect from Southampton. It's an opening game. They played against 10 men for the majority, and Newcastle, very organised and resilient, got the result in their favour. I think from the teams that have come up, a big focus is going to be on all of them to, at the right moment, can they be pragmatic? I don't think any of them should tear up what they've done in the Championship, but the real key, and we've seen this so many times in the past, is having a manager that knows when to just hedge their bets a little bit and be a bit more pragmatic. And I think we saw that with Leicester last night. Steve Cooper's obviously got more experience managing in the Premier League than Kieran McKenna and Russell Martin. So I think they've all got a chance. We spoke about it last week and I gave my predictions and I said that I thought Leicester would survive. I think players, they've got a bit more experience and they've got Vardy. Steve Cooper's effectively said that he'll tell him when he's fit this season, and we'll see really careful management of his game time. He'll play the home games, he'll play selected away games, he won't play in the cup. And as for Southampton, lots of promise, but they need to know when to push and when to hold. And just quickly on the thing with Brereton Diaz, they don't want to see him getting involved in that type of nonsense. They need him scoring goals, they need him in the positions where he can impact games, not trying to get players sent off and then getting them sent off, because that just upsets the entire balance of what Russell Martin's trying to do.
And they need people to be professional. There is less than 14 days left in the transfer window. When are we expecting the fire sale or the online auction at Chelsea?
I mean, it's getting beyond ridiculous. There was a bit on Sky Sports last night after the game talking about Jamie Carragher saying that, you know, where are they going to fit all these players? Have they got space in the dressing room? And there was a story from The Athletic this morning from a club source from a while back saying that in the past with team meetings, they've had to have players sitting in the corridor. There's that many of them, 42 first team players registered on the website. Obviously, that has to be cut to 25 to be sent to the Premier League. There's, you know, various rules surrounding homegrown players and under-21s players that don't fit into that. But whichever way you slice it, they're probably going to have to get rid of at least 5 or 6 first-team players between now and the transfer window closing. And this possibility of João Félix swapping with Conor Gallagher, that doesn't solve that. It helps them from a financial fair play or rather a PSR setting, because it's pure profit that will be put down on the form, as it were, for Conor Gallagher. But João Félix, when he was there last time, there was little flashes of promise, but ultimately he's had quite an unfulfilled career. Question marks over the type of character that he is. Is he someone that Enzo Maresca will be appreciative of in the way that he carries himself? And then you've got Raheem Sterling likely to move on, Romelu Lukaku and one or two others potentially. So it is a bit of a mess. And there's huge questions. I think it goes all the way back to the decision to get rid of Pochettino and bring in Maresca, a manager that's never managed in the Premier League before, coming into a very volatile club that just has too many players, and he needs to get rid of them. He probably doesn't even know the majority of them. He's been there so little. He's probably still learning some names. They've had players come back from loan and that kind of thing. So there has to be at least, I would say, 5 gone by the end of the month.
Well, Maresca wasn't saying too much about it. Neither was Thomas Frank about Ivan Toney going to Saudi Arabia, but it looks like his career at Brentford is over.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, because if you kind of rewind 6 months, even after he came back from the suspension, there was lots of interest. Arsenal, Manchester United, Liverpool, all considering him as this kind of final piece of the jigsaw to get them the goals and close that margin in behind Manchester City. None of them are interested anymore, despite the fact that he's shown that he still is able to score goals at a Premier League level. The move to Saudi Arabia, we all know the motivation behind that, and it is financial. Obviously, the wages that he'll be offered will be far more than he's on at Brentford or what Brentford could offer him. But I just think there's no way to mask it other than that. If he stays at Brentford, does relatively well for them this season, 15-plus Premier League goals, maybe the Premier League interest gets revived in him. If that doesn't happen and he leaves and goes to Saudi Arabia, I do not see a Premier League club going back for him in a year or two's time. It could just be the end of his top flight career, all for the sake of going and earning a huge amount of money. But that is the way that a lot of footballers are thinking in the last 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, it's a little bit disappointing, but hey, it's their prerogative. Erik ten Hag looks like he wants to move on. Scott McTominay, I'd head Jibet, that Jadon Sancho might go with him, but if he gets rid of both of them, he has to find a midfielder. Any rumours as to who it might be?
Well, the big one that they've been going for the last couple of weeks is Manuel Ugarte from Paris Saint-Germain, but they need to raise money for that. They've obviously spent quite a bit in the last couple of weeks. They brought in Yoro and Xerxes earlier on in the transfer window, and then Masraoui and De Ligt last week. So there needs to be a balancing in terms of outgoings, and they'll get probably the bones of 100 million for McTominay and Sancho put together, which could then be used to finance a move for Ugarte. I think United fans are generally quite positive about Scott McTominay. He's someone that has done well for them.
Scored plenty of goals, anyway.
Scored plenty of goals, scores important goals. He works very hard. He's got really good attitude. He's probably a bit underrated how technically he is. He is actually a very good player. He just maybe isn't as fancy, for want of a better word, as some of his teammates and some other Premier League midfielders. Jadon Sancho, despite the fact that him and Erik ten Hag seem to have patched things up over the summer, I just think the previous relationship just created this rift between them that if he stays, it will be a case of that he has to stay and Ten Hag will have to just kind of work with the situation. But neither of them are particularly happy working alongside each other. And obviously Jadon Sancho would have been in the position that the rest of us were before that FA Cup final, thinking that Erik Ten Hag probably loses that game, loses his job, a new manager comes in and we see a different Jadon Sancho. That's not the case. And now it looks as if Sancho will move on. Potential that he could get included in the Ugarte deal. PSG are one of the names interested in him. But I think if they want to push hard for Ugarte, they need to get rid of at least one of McTominay or Sancho. Ten Hag's hunch would probably be Sancho. He can do more with McTominay in the way that he likes to set the team up. But there needs to be a lot done. As you say, the window is getting closer to closing. There needs to be quite a bit done between here and there.
Gerard Brantwaite was mentioned earlier in the summer as possibly going from Everton to Manchester United, but looking up or rooting around this afternoon anyway, Fergal, it looks like Liverpool might be interested.
This is a really bizarre one, and I think there is some legs to it. I've been speaking to a couple of colleagues who work very, very closely to both clubs without giving too much away, and they've both said from both sides that this is not a kind of gossip rumour. This is something that has been floated. I don't think it will necessarily work out, certainly not in this transfer window because of the time left and the amount of money that it would take. I think it would talk of 70 million plus that Everton were asking Manchester United for. He's had a groin operation over the summer, so that maybe would kind of set back a move this summer as well, because his pre-season's been limited and it might have an impact on how quickly he could go into a new team. But don't forget, Virgil van Dijk out of contract next summer. No progress at this stage over whether he'll be offered a renewal, and Liverpool will be needing a new commanding centre-back. So I think it could be something that gets floated a little bit further down the line. For this window, for everything that would be involved in it, I think it'd be a bit of a stretch.
It could possibly be a bit of a stretch. And it looks like Darragh O'Shea is either going to move to Brentford or Wolves. Which one would be the good call for him?
I think Brentford initially with a name mentioned. I think the interest is a bit stronger from their position. Obviously, we just mentioned Tony, so there could be money coming in that would fund a push for O'Shea and one or two others. I was asked about it last week. It needs to be the right move for him. He's bounced around a couple of clubs and kind of floated with this thing of that he is a Premier League player, but he has been relegated last season, and he wants to be a Premier League player. He wants to compete at that level for his own development, and obviously the benefit that would bring playing for Ireland as well. But it needs to be the right call for him. Wolves, obviously under Gary O'Neill, have shown a lot of faith in the manager. He signed a new contract in the summer, but they've lost Max Kilman who I think is a really good defender. So that's big shoes to fill there. And then at Brentford, Thomas Frank, he's a bit of a creature of habit in terms of his defence. He's got some very, very experienced players there, and Nathan Collins as well, Ben Mee, Christoph Ayer. It would be tough to force your way into the starting 11 in either of those teams. And the last thing Darragh O'Shea needs is accept a big move back into the Premier League and then be the first reserve off the bench, because that just doesn't help anybody, and certainly not him.
It most certainly does, and I'm afraid we're running out of time, but Andrew Moran has joined Stoke City. Of course, he is contracted with Brighton, but he's taken a step down to the Championship this year. Young man, right move for him?
Hopefully. There was an interview with John Walters this morning, who's involved in the Stoke setup, and he was full of praise for him. He was good for Blackburn last year, and I think, again, another player where it needs to be the right move. It can't just be a case of going out and getting minutes and kind of building himself up in that sense. It needs to be a progressive move for his career. Is he going to get the amount of football and the type of football that he needs to then go back to Brighton and be in a position to possibly break into their first team? I hope so. Stoke are not the team that they were once upon a time. That they are a bit more progressive and a bit more creative than they were when we associate them with the Premier League days. But still, it's a very difficult one to call. Championship is such a hard league, physically demanding. I really hope it works for him, because he's such a talented player, and he's exactly the type of player, the skill set that he's got, that Ireland need building forward, because someone that can play passes to unlock defences, he's got really good work rate, creative, clever. I really, really hope it works out for him, because he's very, very talented.
I hope it does too. I suspect, though, Fergal, in the next 13 days there will be lots of action in the transfer window. Thanks a million for taking our call. We have a quick break to take, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Aidan O'Brien.
Game on, racing.
Welcome back to Game On. So tomorrow afternoon is day one of the York Ebor Festival. Four cracking days action on the Knaves Mire, and what an international spice there is to tomorrow's Judmont International. City of Troy is the Irish favourite. For the UK, you have Ambiente Friendly, the French of Caladigan, and Zarakam, the Japanese runner Juriza, even the Philly Blue Stocking. It's an incredible contest tomorrow afternoon. It goes to post at around about 3:35. The favourite is City of Troy, and his trainer Aidan O'Brien joins us on the line. Aidan, I can't remember a Judmont with 13 runners before. This looks a really good race.
Yeah, absolutely, Ruby. I think so. I think it's a long time. I was listening to everybody there today. It's a long time since there were that many runners, is right. And the quality is high. So I think that's what kind of everybody wants in those big races. Kind of obviously you have them as competitive as possible, and horses from all different parts of the world, really. So it's a very exciting race, Ruby. Absolutely.
City of Troy, Aidan, got himself back on track after his blowout in the Guineas with a win in the Epsom Derby in June. You brought him to Sandown then for the Eclipse, and there's no point in beating around the bush here. I thought he was workmanlike in the Eclipse, Aidan. What was your own take on it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This would be a good analysis of it, I think. We were very happy with him. The ground was softer than we would have wanted, and maybe the pace wasn't as strong as we would have liked. He just got kind of trapped down the inside off the bend, and there was it was well watered, and they got some rain, and there was kind of boggy, soft patches in it, and he just got a little bit bogged down in it and never really got into his open rhythm, really. But we were very happy with him then. He won nicely in then, but obviously everybody was probably expecting him to be more impressive. But it won nicely. Wasn't as impressive as everyone thought, but we were happy with him. We felt that he won kind of despite the conditions, really, of the pace of the race and the ground.
Well, look, at the end of the day, it's about winning. He won an Eclipse. That's exactly what he did. But he's a horse whose ability you've never hidden, or your admiration for him. You've always been very bullish about City of Troy. Good to firm ground in tomorrow's international. What are you hoping for?
Yeah, no, that'd be perfect for me. Like, obviously, he's a big, long, low stride. He stays very well, and we always thought York would suit him very well. So, we're looking forward to seeing him run now, actually. His conditions, everything looks perfect. I think it's good to firm. There's some winter, or there's some kind of a thundery weather around, but they don't think they'll get much rain. So hopefully it'll stay that way. Obviously, York can turn very quickly. But hoping the ground will stay that way, and it'll be a nice, even, level race, really, and really looking forward to him running, really.
Yeah, of course you are. Look, Aidan, obviously you are the front man for a huge business that is Ballydoyle, Coolmore, it's Stallions, it's promotion of the sport, it's the whole shooting gallery. What more could, where else will you go with City of Troy? He is the flag bearer. You're trying to make a big name stallion out of him. If he goes and wins tomorrow, what would his plan be from there?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Obviously, we kind of decide after every run, the lads decide really. Obviously, he would have a choice of going back to Leopardstown. Obviously, he would have a choice of going to America for the Classic at the end of the season. So I think they're all very realistic options for him. Obviously, we always take one race at a time and we'll see what will happen first. But could come back to Leopardstown, could go straight to the Breeders' Cup Classic, could have a work on the sand somewhere if he was going to do that. So, I think we get over tomorrow first. But like I said, a Leopardstown would definitely be an option. Breeders' Cup Classic would definitely be an option. But if he was doing that, he'd probably have to have a race or a work somewhere in between.
The Breeders' Cup Classic. You just failed with Giants Causeway many years ago. I think that's one you want to take off, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. We've been placed in a good few times. It's a tough race to win. It's obviously tougher when the horses that we run in it have been running on grass, and it's a switch over onto dirt, and everyone knows how demanding the dirt is and how hard it is to acclimatise to it in a quick time. So it's a great race, obviously, and like you said, we haven't won it, so it would be unbelievable to win it sometime. But you need a very tough horse to stay as well, and has to be tactical, has to have tactical speed, and has to fight at the end. So it's a lot of stuff has to fall from, and I suppose racing coming from this part of the world, from grass to dirt, it makes it even more difficult, really.
It does, and it's not just the surface. The dirt racing is a completely different style. I mean, it's from the stalls, hammer and tongs. It's much different how we race, and how do you alter how you train a horse to get him ready for a dirt race?
Yeah, sure. I suppose you kind of nearly have to train them like a sprinter, really. And they have to hit the gates, and they have to run hard, and they have to do them 11 and a halfs all the way, or kind of just under 12s all the way. And you really train them like a sprinter, and then you have to hope that they have enough stamina at the end. And then when the stamina runs out, the courage has to kick in. So it's very tough, very demanding, you know. And that's the way I think it is, and that's the way you have to treat it. Get through the races first here, and then the tempo has to heat up and step up, and then they have to be able to deal with the early pace and have to fight very hard at the end, really.
Yeah, that'd be some challenge for City of Troy, were he to win the Judmont and head on to there. It would be a great thing to achieve. Aidan, there's loads of races in York. Obviously, tomorrow you've got the Great Voltigeur as well. You're well represented in that with Los Angeles, the Irish Derby winner. Has he progressed from the Curragh?
We think he has. We supplemented him for the race, even though he'll have a penalty, and are thinking behind it. Obviously, he's a very strong candidate for the Ledger, but by running him tomorrow, we'll get a run into him, and we could go back to an Irish champion if we wanted to, if City of Troy wasn't going back there, and if the other Ledger horses looked like they could win the Ledger. Obviously, Illinois is in there as well, and he loves the mile and six trip, loves fast ground. Then we have Jan Bergal, the horse that won in Goodwood. It will go straight there, and I suppose we'll see what will happen. But by running him tomorrow, even though he has a penalty, win, lose or draw, it gives us options where we can go or want to go. If he was to go to the Irish champion, then he could go on to an arc. Obviously, if he went, he could still go to the Ledger and go back to an arc. So I suppose it just leaves him a lot of options after tomorrow, really.
You'll have to look, I know he's a 10 furlong winner in St. Cloud last year, and he beat Euphoric over 10 furlongs at Leopardstown in May, but you have enough confidence in Los Angeles that he has the speed to drop back for an Irish champion?
It's very possible he has, Ruby. Yes, he obviously, the mile and a quarter he won in St. Cloud was in soft ground, and it was soft ground in Leopardstown, but he never goes like a soft ground horse, you know. He does handle it because obviously he's by Camelot. We think he has loads of class. We thought you could go back to an Irish champion, you could finish in the first three or four, and you can still go back and win an arc. So we kind of would use it as a stepping stone, obviously, thinking and hoping that he could be very competitive, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Drop down and trip, sharpen up and have him ready for the big one in Paris in early October. Aidan, you're running the line in the winter in the Acom tomorrow, and he runs into ruling court of Godolphins, of course. They look two fairly outstanding two-year-olds to be taking each other on to Group 2, Group 3.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a tough race for a group race, and it suits our horse, because we were thinking that we could go back for the Goff's Million after this, and we needed another run somewhere in between, and we could have went to the Curragh for Futurity, but we have the Wooden Basset horse that won at the Curragh the last day going there, so we were just trying
Delacroix,
to split
is
them
it?
Up. Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
the Wooden Basset of Immortal Verse. He won the Group 3, the 6 furlongs at the Curragh the last day. So, so we were trying to split them up, give him experience, but obviously the Justify horse looks very good of Charlie. So it will be a good experience for him, and we're going to learn a lot about him, and he's going to learn a lot about racing, we think.
There's big races every day. On Thursday, Content gets a chance to make up for, I suppose, a little bit of unluck in the Irish Oaks.
Yeah, we put in a pacemaker, and our other filly sat second in the Irish Oaks, and the pacemaker didn't really go. So because of that, the pace didn't really open up for us. And she's a little bit keen, so right now it always takes his time on her. But obviously, you know, when you're taking your time, you need the brakes and you need the feed to open up. So it never really opened up at the Curragh until it was kind of over. Ryan rode her exactly like we felt and he thought was the right thing, and it definitely was. But the race didn't open up in time. So hopefully in York, the pace will be stronger, and he'll take his time with her, I presume, again. But he will decide that. Hopefully she'll get a little bit more space and we'll see exactly what she can do. We were very happy the last day. It was her first time up to a mile and a half, and it definitely looked like she wasn't going to have any problem with a strong mile and a half. So we're going to learn a lot with her, but she's very well sensed. Her work is very good, and everyone seems very happy with her sense.
Friday's feature is the Coolmore Nuntop, but Aidan O'Brien, you've no runner in the Nuntop. You may get on to the lads to get you a few sprinters. I mean, Group 1 race is going without you, but you do have one in the Lonsdale, and that is Point Lonsdale, aptly named for the Lonsdale. You're stepping him up in trip, a bit like Broome. He's plenty of runs in Group 1s. How do you think he'll cope with 2 miles?
Yeah, he's a lovely, genuine horse. We never really stepped him up until Chester this year. We stepped him up to 1.07 and won very easy. He was kind of waiting in the wings for a lot of those races, and other horses were getting the slot instead of him. And in all fairness to him, he's a kind horse, and he's an easy horse to train, and he kind of kept coming to the boil and going back again, and you know what that's like. So we eventually had to run him, and we ran him in St. Cloud in 1.5 miles for Group 1, and he ran very well. We were delighted with the run, really. He wasn't beaten very far. So we had it in our head that he would come back here. Obviously, it's up to 2 miles. Brian thinks he should have no problem with it. He's a very relaxed, lazy horse. So it will be interesting. But obviously, when you're going those kind of trips, you're never sure. But he has loads of class. He's very competitive at Group 1 level over 1.5 miles and even at 1.25 miles. So he has a lazy way of racing. So he's always a little bit deceiving. So you probably always think that he's going to stay better than he does. But Ryan was very happy with him in Chester, and he felt like to go further than 1.07 miles was going to be no problem. So it will be interesting to see. He will improve from the run, because we were stopping and starting a little bit. But we're looking forward to seeing him run now as well.
Not very often you have a runner in the Ebor, but you do have the favourite this year in Queenstown, who's been doing plenty of the donkey work for Kyprios this year. Is he going to get his big day in the sun?
Well, hopefully. He was a Kyprios' sparring partner, obviously, through the whole season. And obviously, he was getting it tough every day, as you know, when you're working, leading, and with a big horse like that. So he was well. We were going to run him in Ascot, and Queen Alexandra was the 2.05 miles at the end of the meeting. The vets trotted him up, and he was a little bit stiff and sore, but we were happy enough with him, but they weren't happy. So we obviously, he didn't get through the vets, so he didn't run. So he came back and we gave him a little break, and he's been working by himself now. He hasn't been doing the donkey work for Kyprios since then. We think he's in good form. We think he's ready to run. Is he as fit as he was when he was leading Kyprios? Probably not, because the intensity of the work wouldn't have been as strong or as tough. But we're happy where he is, and we always thought he was going to be a horse that was going to suit this type of race. We think he will improve because he's first run back, but he is working well and he's in good order. He's a lazy way of racing, but stays very well, we think. So it will be interesting to see.
He must feel like he's on holidays now, having to lead Kyprios. He must be absolutely delighted with himself. Queenstown.
Yeah, he does. He's having a great life at the moment, and he can't believe it. So hopefully, yeah.
Hopefully it goes right for him. Aidan, if there's a division that's really exciting me this year, it's the 2-year-old fillies. You have Heaven's Gate and the Louder. You've got all your other good fillies, Lake Victoria, Fairy Godmother, Bedtime Story. They're all in at the weekend. The 2-year-old fillies look exceptional this season.
Yeah, they look nice so far. They're obviously very well bred fillies, and they they are, you'd have to be very happy with them. The filly we run, the Louder, is a tough, hardy filly. She was in Ascot and she won in Nace, the Ballyhane, only a week before last, and came out with it very well. Obviously, Bedtime Story runs at the Curragh of the weekend. She's lovely, sweet, natural filly. She relaxes and quickens and looks like she's getting seven very well. So she's exciting. They seem a very nice team of fillies at the moment, and they're keeping away from each other at the moment. No, couldn't be happier, really.
Well, they look a cracking bunch. Look in, look, Lake Victoria and Fairy Godmother and a couple of Geraldines and Dermot Wells, and it looks to be an exceptional bunch of two-year-olds. Aidan, you'll be over and back all week, busy as ever. Is York a week you enjoy?
Yes, yeah, it's just great racing, Ruby. It's unbelievable racing, really. I think it's what everyone wants to see. It's very competitive. They do a great job with everybody. Everyone is very well looked after. There's a great atmosphere. It's a lovely place. I think it's a week that everyone looks forward to and enjoys, really. I think York is this time of the year, just really know her better, really.
Well, I think that's as good a way as any way to finish this conversation, because I fully agree with you, Aidan. Thanks a million for taking our call. All the best this week. We have another commercial break to take, and when we come back, Shane Stokes will bring us up to date on the Vuelta a España.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So this afternoon did see stage 4 of the Vuelta a España take place. They climbed all the way to Pico Villarucas, and as you predicted yesterday, Shane Stokes, Primoz Roglic has come to the fore.
Yeah, you can set your clock by Primoz Roglic in the Vuelta a España. He always seems to make it on time in terms of getting over injuries or whatever has been ailing him. So yeah, he won today. He very nearly didn't win today because of a young Belgian rider, a very talented guy called Leonard Van Itveld, who looked like he had the stage one and prematurely celebrated at the top of the climb. He put his arm up in the air, and next thing, Primoz Roglic swept past. So, Roglic is kind of a master at those kind of finishes, kind of sprint at the top of a steep hill. And I'd say it's the last time Van Itveld will do that in his career.
Oh, an expensive lesson for the young Belgian rider. But Primoz won the stage, and he's also on top of the general classifications. Kind of what you expected, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's actually fractured his back in a crash in the Tour. So I suppose the big question was, would he get over that in time? Because he hasn't raced between the Vuelta and the Tour, or rather between the Tour and the Vuelta, but he clearly is in form. There was speculation, or the TV commentators today were wondering, was there maybe a little bit of exaggeration in terms of how waylaid he'd been, or how sidetracked he'd been by the injury, that maybe the team exaggerated it slightly. Not the injury itself, but how long he was off the bike, because certainly he was in very, very strong form today. And I think based on what you could see today, indeed the time gaps he's opened over the other riders, he really is the clear favourite for the overall win. He's taken 3 Vueltas in the past, and if he wins this year, it'll be a record-equaling fourth win for him.
He will indeed. He is in the red jersey. It was a tough day for Eddie Dunbar, finished back in 41st. Dan Martin did say to us last night that the heat is a killer in the Vuelta. How did Eddie cope with it?
Yeah, exactly. And Eddie said that after the stage, that the heat was a big, big factor. He had told me last week going into the race that his form, because he's had a cruciate ligament injury from the Vuelta, that his form had not been where he wanted it to be. He was hoping to be going okay in the race, and hoping to build form as the race goes on. He certainly wasn't at his best today. He'll hope for better. I think the heat was a big factor, he said afterwards, and also the steepness of the climb. But there is an audio from him from today's stage, so hopefully we'll hear him now.
No, just warm. Just trying to stay on top. We did it well, actually. We rode very well. Just a little late on that steep climb. Trying to limit my losses. So we'll see. Yeah. See his damage. Later on, then, though. Disappointed.
Yes, that's Eddie giving his initial thoughts after the stage. And he also mentions that there's a long way to go and a load of other days with very tough climbs where he can make up time, but certainly it wasn't the ideal start for him.
No, it wasn't. Darren Rafferty, the other Irish rider, was performing domestic duties this afternoon for Richard Carapaz. He looked comfortable enough.
Yeah, he's a very talented guy. He's in his first year as a pro. He's a very young rider, but he's faring very well. So what he did say is he worked to get Richard Carapaz in the right position. Unfortunately, Richard Carapaz himself didn't perform. He finished a good way back, but he was 1 minute 29 back. But Darren did very good riding for him and then just sat up before that climb and lost time. But I think the name of the game is when you're on domestic duties is you do your job and then you just try and save energy for the next day. But with Carapaz losing time, and if Carapaz continues to be off form, it really does open things up for Darren to go stage hunting, which would be a nice goal for his first Grand Tour. So, but he's certainly showing well so far.
It most certainly would. Shane, I didn't get time to mention it yesterday, but you told me I should. The Tour de France Femme finished at the weekend, and you said it was an incredible finish on the Alpe d'Huez.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. You might remember the Greg LeMond versus Laurent Fignon duel in the men's race back in 1989, which was seen as the best Grand Tour finish ever. And there's people saying, and I'd agree, that this was maybe even better again. So Greg LeMond was behind on that final time trial and ended up winning overall by 8 seconds, which was the smallest winning margin in any Tour de France. But Cassia Numa-Doma was leading going into the final stage. She had taken the race lead after Demi Vollering, the defending champion, crashed during this year's race, and she started the final stage 1:15 behind. And Vollering put in a huge attack 54 kilometres from the finish on the Col de Glandon and rapidly gained time in Numa-Doma. So it looked like the race was slipping away from the Polish rider, but she really, really fought hard on the Alpe d'Huez, which is the iconic, one of the most iconic climbs in the Tour, and salvaged the yellow jersey. She finished 1 minute 11 seconds back, so won by 4 seconds, which looking at the men and women's Tour together, it's the closest ever finish, but it really was an incredible finish and full of emotion, full of suspense.
Yeah, we must look it up because it sounds like it was incredible. Tomorrow afternoon is stage 5 of the Vuelta, bit of a transfer from today to tomorrow's starting point. What's in store tomorrow afternoon for the riders?
Yeah, tomorrow it's lumpy early on, but it does have the hallmarks of a sprint finish. I mean, towards the end, it gets very, very flat. It finishes in Sevilla, or Seville, as people might know. It does look like a bunch sprint, or maybe a select bunch sprint, where the lumpy train early on might get rid of some of the heavier climbers. But it looks like it's heading in that direction. And then the following day is to Junquera, and that's another uphill finish. It's not as difficult as today's finish, but it could be an explosive finish for sure. And Eddie Dunbar will hope to have better legs then and to try and show himself in the race.
One interesting thing I thought, looking at the stages for the Vuelta and the map, as you look it up, they finished stage 7 in Cordoba, stage 8 in Cazorla, and then in 9 in Granada. But then they start stage 10 all the way up in Ponteiras, which is 10 hours from Granada. Logistically, do they fly? Drive?
I'm not 100% sure. Actually, often they do, but the reason why I'm not sure is that there is pressure on in terms of climate change to make races more sustainable. So the UCI, which is the world governing body, is trying to say to race organisers, look, these long transfers and indeed internal flights are not on. So the Vuelta, you know, a lot of other races are, you know, if you look at the maps of other races, they're becoming closer together, the stages, which is minimising this amount of transfer. But the Vuelta this year is very much continuing, and it's done that in the past where there's been very big gaps between the starts and finishes of stages. So that's something that's to be looked at, because I was recently at the Tour of Norway, and that race has got fully electrical vehicles in the race convoy. So they're going, you know, very much in a sustainable direction. And that's the way that cycling, if you consider the amount of vehicles that travel on a race. Cycling itself is obviously a very environmental pursuit, but professional cycling, with the amount of vehicles travelling around, you know, the Vuelta, Tour of France, etc., you know, the electrification of the cavalcade is certainly a consideration. And these 10-hour distances between stages is going in the opposite direction where it needs to go. It's also hard on the riders as well, of course, you know, whether they drive or whether they fly or whatever, but it's quite complicated.
It most certainly is. Shane Stokes, thanks for taking our call. I'm delighted to say, though, that Isabel Joyce has joined us on the line today. It mightn't have been the women's cricketers afternoon this afternoon, Isabel, but a 2-1 series win over Sri Lanka is a day to be happy about.
Absolutely. I mean, it was kind of a strange one after the game because they were celebrating a series win, but you know, they definitely didn't perform how they wanted to in the third day. But I kind of thought that performance might happen on the second day after the first victory ever in ODIs against Sri Lanka. But they backed up the first performance. Lots of injuries for Ireland as well, so it might have been a tall task to whitewash Sri Lanka.
It might have been a tall order to whitewash. Does psychologically too, though, when you've won a series, is it hard to get yourself up for the last game?
I don't think so. I think, you know, they had lots of people coming in and out, and maybe just Sri Lanka came to the party a little bit more. They figured out their tactics better as well. And definitely tougher conditions. It was windy. The pitch was a bit tired. And, you know, they also had a bit of luck, Sri Lanka. They got wickets with the first two deliveries of the game. So that was absolutely nightmare stuff for Ireland, and they had to fight back. So they kind of had to spend a lot of time at the crease and see what they could get up to. And Sri Lanka just, you know, were on form today. They were disappointed with how they went, particularly with the bat in the series. But I think with their bowling unit, when they performed today, they brought in some new bowlers, and it was definitely the right matchup.
This women's team are next up against England in September time, T20 and Monday's 3-1-day internationals. Will they be looking forward to that?
Yeah, it's the first time England have ever, would you believe, travelled to Ireland to play a series against the women, which is just incredible. You know, we kind of see them every now and then at World Cups. We've gone over once or twice to play their senior team, but it's a long time since we've really played them in ODIs. This new ICC Women's Championship that the team qualified for means that England have to travel here. So we're interested to see who they're going to send. Are they going to send a full-strength team, which they might do because, as I said, those points are up for grabs. That goes towards World Cup qualification. So they can't afford to send a team and maybe drop a few points. They won't want to do that. I think Ireland, having beaten Sri Lanka for the first time in this series and doing it twice, they'll have players going back in after lots of injuries. So I think, you know, they'll fancy their chances of a bit of an upset in that series, if not once, then twice or three times like the series against Sri Lanka just now.
That'll be great. The first of those games is on the 7th of September. Isabel, thanks a million for taking our call. A big thanks to Adam O'Dea, who was the sound coordinator tonight. Andrew O'Connor produced. Rachel May Hannan is up next with the music show. That's all we have time for.
RTE 2FM.